this is definitely. I hope that the reason that everybody came is a very positive reason, rather than just wanting to come to see this fictitious person, Hayden, go through some kind of number up here, because I don't really have a number. And what always mystifies me is why people would come out in such large numbers as today just to see somebody or see some character, when the same number of people have it within their power, if they come together, to restore this person to the faculty, to change the service role that this college plays for the growers in the state of California, to remove the president of the institution, to change all of the programs. And there is a very strange thing that happens. People only come together around certain things that very often drain their strength. People come together to see some kind of spectacular performance, like is alleged by the police about that's supposed to happen today or something. But they don't come together out of a sense of their own strength so much. And I really don't want this kind of meeting to be that kind of meeting where people drain themselves by participating in this kind of radical consumption. And I don't think that that's the motivation necessarily, the reason that a lot of people came here. I think maybe a more positive way to look at it is to see it as a political act, rather than a speech or a rally or something like that. A political act, a modest one, but a political act in defiance of these absurd restrictions that have been described to you, and which are not isolated to this particular college, but are coming down all the colleges all across the state of California and around the country. It becomes not a matter of free speech, but a matter virtually of resisting illegitimate authority to give a speech on a campus in the state of California. It means that you have to get into a contradiction and a confrontation with Dumkey, with the local president, with all of the officials, all the way down to, very often, to the student governments who function as lackeys of the the state administrative structure. And we shouldn't be fooled, of course, by the reasons that are given for why these restrictions have to occur, because the reasons that are given also start from the assumption that students are some kind of volatile mass that only requires a chemical ingredient, like a radical speaker, to go off, cause an explosion, that you are sort of nothing more than a vat of gasoline and I'm a match, and all that's necessary is for us to come together and the whole school will explode. This is the reasoning that is in the minds of the administration and is in the minds of some people in this room who are not really allowed to be in this room according to the administrative regulations that were read to you, and that's the FBI agents and the undercover police. Only accredited journalists, students, staff, faculty, and so forth are supposed to be here. There's another, there's another element that's here in the room, which if we ask to stand up, will not stand up, right? Servants of the people, on the public salary, red-blooded American FBI agents and undercover agents. And this is another reason that people have a difficult time coming together. People have a difficult time feeling a sense of spirit or community in a crowd like this, not simply because we feel that we're maybe following this consumer ethic, but also because you really can't relate very happily together with one another if you think the person next to you may be taking notes on your behavior during the speech. They have many ways to destroy our ability to gain some sense of community, even for a moment, and not the least of which is the pervasive presence of spies, snoops, and agents of all kinds, some of them with long hair, by the way. some of them with who go to school on not the usual fellowship, but you know, they get a little more than, they get sort of a veteran's payoff before becoming a veteran. It's like they're sent to the battlefield here rather than to Vietnam, and they receive a different kind of stipend for going to school. And all of these things are related to the fact that the people who run the universities, people who run the country, really don't know what's going on around them or how to deal with it, really feel extremely isolated, really feel extremely embarrassed. And bringing out people in this large number, therefore, is a political act because it causes greater hysteria, greater embarrassment, makes them feel that they have no control over you, makes them gauge your numbers and your potential strength. And this is therefore more a show of strength and a show of numbers than it is some kind of speech. Now, I understand that this has never happened before. There have never been large rallies on the campus, not in this room. Were there during Cambodia? Ms. Penny Ray, there was no demonstrations during Cambodia? It was smaller. So this is like the largest crowd that's ever assembled here. Well, except for Art Linkletter. On this little plane that came from Los Angeles bringing me here, the pilots had a, when Art Linkletter came, they had this great big sign on the plane, something like, "Go get him, Art Linkletter. Welcome, Art Linkletter." They had a huge case of RC Cola, especially for him. And they, this has been going on a long time. For many years, you know, people have said that their campus can't get together. And then one after another, some of the larger campuses did start getting together. Things did start to happen. Education began, demonstrations began, action began. Pretty soon there was the growth of some kind of student movement. And there were always other campuses where people said that nothing can happen here. It can only happen at Columbia, or it can only happen in Ann Arbor or Berkeley or something like that. Well, I think that since Kent State and since Isla Vista, all that has changed. And very often the campuses that are in the vanguard are the campuses where nothing has happened. And so you shouldn't feel badly about the fact that nothing has happened here yet. You should take that as a mandate of history, a writ that allows you to sort of start on a fresh basis and do something drastic that will change the history of this area. From a history of the Hearst Empire, the American Empire, history of the conquistadors, a history of the white people who came here to take the land from the Chicano people and the Indians, and turn it all around. Because the only way that especially young whites, white people in general, are going to re-enter history, except in the present role we have of being historically the enemy of most of the people of the world, is by changing, erasing, and rewriting that history through action. And this is going to be a very long process. One example, the best example I could give is just saying something about the fact that we really don't understand even the history of this area, the history of California, the history of ourselves. This brother from Vietnam is really recounting to you and to me the last chapter, the latest chapter, in a very long history, which is the history of blood, which is the history of the white settlers of this continent. And one thing that is really suppressed and that requires black studies and Chicano studies and Native American studies to uncover is this history of blood, which is our history. Like a lot of people say, well, why should there be third world studies? And they sort of think that third world studies maybe are good for people who want to catch up on some neglected side of history without realizing that if that side of history is not recorded in the history books, then our history as white people is not recorded accurately in the history books either. And so through these struggles to recapture the history of people whose histories have been erased, we start to recapture some of our own. And the place where it's most evident is here in California, is here up and down the state. And until we understand how all of these places that are very nice when we think of them, like Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, Death Valley, San Luis Obispo, names that ring happy memories in our minds from history, until we realize that these places, which are now resorts, which are now areas for the rich and areas for people who can retire, till we realize that these are areas, like somebody earlier said, that are really conquered areas, which have a history of blood, we cannot understand anything about our own selves. And I'm going to give you an example. There's a brilliant book about Indian history one example from which will show you the direct relationship between the bloody period 100 years ago and what's going on in Vietnam today. In fact, what I'm going to read you is the testimony of a white veteran of the Indian Wars, specifically in Colorado. And this white veteran has nothing more or less to say than the veterans who now are returning and testifying before Congressman Dellums or speaking out about the war crimes that they've participated in or observed in Vietnam. And when you see the parallel, you begin to see sort of where we're at very exactly. This brother's name was Robert Bent. He was testifying approximately 100 years ago about a massacre at Sand Creek, one of the thousands of My Lies in the wars of the white people against the Indians. This particular settlement of Indians was supposedly a pacified area. The pacification program at that time required that the Indians put up the Yankee flag around their settlement to show that they had laid down their arms, that they had made a treaty, that they were not going to go off the reservation and so forth. And these Indians thought that they were safe. The Indians thought that everything was all right. And this is Robert Bent's description of what happened to these Indians who accepted the pacification program as he rode with Colonel Shivington towards their camp at Sand Creek. "I saw the American flag waving and heard Black Kettle tell the Indians to stand around the flag. And there they were huddled, men, women, and children. This was when we were within 50 yards of the Indians. I also saw a white flag raised. These flags were in so conspicuous a position that they must have been seen. When the troops fired, the Indians ran, some of the men into their lodges, probably to get whatever arms were available. I think there were 600 Indians in all. I think that there were only 35 braves and some old men, about 60 in all, that day. The rest of the men were away from camp hunting. After the firing, the warriors put the squaws and children together and surrounded them to protect them. I saw 5 squaws under a bank for shelter. When the troops came up to them, they ran out and showed their persons to let the soldiers know that they were squaws and begged for mercy. But the soldiers shot them all. I saw 1 squaw lying on the bank whose leg had been broken by a shell. A soldier came up to her with a drawn saber. She raised her arm to protect herself when he struck, breaking her arm. She rolled over and raised her other arm. He struck again, breaking it, and then left her without killing her. There seemed to be indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children. There were some 30 or 40 squaws collected in a hole for protection. They sent out a little girl about 6 years old with a white flag on a stick. She had not proceeded but a few steps when she was shot and killed. All the squaws in that hole were afterwards killed, and 4 or 5 men outside. The squaws offered no resistance. Everyone I saw dead was scalped. I saw one squaw cut open with an unborn child. Captain Sully afterwards told me that such was the fact. I saw the body of White Antelope, it's one of the chiefs, with the privates cut off. And I heard a soldier say he was going to make a tobacco pouch out of them. I saw one squaw whose privates had been cut out. I saw a little girl about 5 years of age who had been hid in the sand. Two soldiers discovered her, drew their pistols and shot her, then pulled her out of the sand by the arm. I saw quite a number of infants in arms killed with their mothers. In a public speech made in Denver shortly before this massacre, Colonel Shivington advocated the killing and scalping of all Indians, including infants. Nits make lice, he declared. Lieutenant James Connor was also there and testified as follows the next day. In going over the battleground the next day, I did not see a body of a man, woman, or child which was not scalped. In many instances, their bodies were mutilated in the most horrible manner. Men, women, and children's privates cut out, etc. I heard one man say that he had cut out a woman's private parts and he had them for exhibition on a stick. I heard another man say that he had cut the fingers off an Indian to get the rings on the hand. According to the best of my knowledge and belief, these atrocities that were committed were with the knowledge of Colonel Shivington, and I do not know of his taking any measures to prevent them. I heard of one instance of a child a few months old being thrown in the feed box of a wagon, and after being carried some distance, left on the ground to perish. I also heard of numerous instances in which men had cut out the private parts of females and stretched them over their saddle bows and wore them over their hats while riding in the ranks. That's part of the history of this area of the country, and is part of the history that casts a reflection on Vietnam, especially for any people who believe that Vietnam is a new annal in the history of the people who settled this country. Any people who believe that Vietnam is an accident of American foreign policy. Any people who believe that Vietnam came about because we had the wrong man in office. And just by understanding this, we understand much more. May seem very difficult to come to terms with such a murderous history, but unless we come to terms with it, we can't understand our identity, and certain illusions persist. One illusion is, for instance, that we have a democratic tradition in America. This is true for my people, the Irish people who were brought here as slaves, many of them, and who struggled out of slavery to take advantage of the democratic system of government so that today we could become police. This is the history of at least the people who turned out to be winners in the Irish community that I come from. But we know that this democratic history that has put people from the Irish community, for example, into power in this country is a democratic history that from the very beginning excluded all of the people who were native to this continent, excluded all of the people of color who were brought here to this continent. And we know that these things are true. We know that people were here before the whites came. We know about the history of slavery, at least in some abstract or general sense. But what we have to do is make the connections, because very many of us very often also think automatically that we have a democratic country, and it's really a matter of including certain groups of people in that democratic process that's so perfect and so good. And in fact, this democratic process, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, was written really for one and only one group of people. From the history of our country, there has been an unsuccessful struggle to include other groups of people. But more important, the very origins of this form of democracy are in genocide. That's the main thing that you draw from this rewriting and reinterpretation of our history. And It's this same form of government that we're trying to transplant in Vietnam. Hubert Humphrey said we're going to take the Great Society to Asia. And again, it's the establishment of the same kind of institutions, but starting with genocide that's taking place in Vietnam, just as it's taken place here in this country. That's one illusion. Another is we often wonder, why does the United States continue to stay in Vietnam? We also sometimes wonder, why do these white rulers of ours continue to be racist? Why don't they grant these Chicano farm workers right over here across the way their demands? Why is such a rich country? Can't we come to terms with these problems? Why, with such a tradition as ours, can't we raise the standard of living for these people? Why can't we include more people in our colleges and universities? Why can't we end unemployment? You know, and above all, people are really asking themselves, why can't we end this war in Vietnam? Especially students are asking themselves this. And because we can't find an answer, we very often begin to give up on struggling against the war in Vietnam, because the answers seem to be too much of a bummer. Seems like nothing we can do will influence the people who have power. And yet we don't think that there's anything we can do except continuing to try to pressure them. And when pressure doesn't work, we give up. Well, from this other framework, we can understand it differently. The United States government has always been tenacious, has never yielded an inch, has always fought to the death to exterminate people who seem to be in the way of the manifest destiny of this country. The Hearsts and the Mark Hopkins and the people after whom our streets are named and our college buildings are named, the people who are the benefactors of our universities, are people who fought wars of extermination to make it that way. The United States has never really quit fighting a war against any of its enemies, and Vietnam is only the last chapter. This alone could even make you more depressed, right? Could mean that for each name on a building, there's millions of people dead whose histories you do not know, like the Modoc Indians and the hundreds of tribes in California who were exterminated literally by the people who settled this area and who are our direct ancestors. This could be very depressing, but I think that, and here this is just the main thing that I want to say, that it does not have to be depressing if you understand that this sort of shit is coming to an end. And that's the hardest thing to understand. Partly it's hard to understand because we students and white people in general think that if it's going to end, we have to end it. It's part of our continuing arrogance. It's part of our continuing belief that we are like the center of the universe. And not that we shouldn't do everything in our power and lay down our lives to try to end this war in Vietnam, but really it's being ended by the Vietnamese, who are putting up a stern, heroic resistance and are actually defeating the United States government for the first time in the history of the eight wars that this white government has entered into. This is the reason that... if it was not for the Vietnamese people fighting, we would not even have this opportunity to understand our past as clearly as we do. If they had been exterminated, as the Indonesians, for instance, were exterminated with U.S. aid, nothing would have been aroused. The origins of the peace movement, the origins of the nonviolent movement, are in the violent armed resistance and people's war that's being carried out by the Vietnamese. Our right to free speech, our right to have controversies about the war, are not founded on the strength of democratic institutions in America, but are forced by the fact that the Vietnamese are fighting and people are going out of their minds trying to understand why we can't win the war in Vietnam or what we're doing in Vietnam in the first place. But if it was not for the Vietnamese having turned the tide of American history, our free speech would be meaningless, just as meaningless as it is about Biafra or about any other countries which we maybe discuss at lunch briefly, but who pass sort of out of our consciousness because they're not able to grip our consciousness in the way that the Vietnamese do. And if we understand that the United States has been in Vietnam 25 years and is constantly lost at each stage of escalating the war, then we understand a whole lot. We understand the paranoia of officials that makes it dangerous for me to come here or something like that. We often ask ourselves why these college administrators get so hysterical. Why does Nixon get so hysterical? Why does Agnew flip out? Why don't they just like, why don't they act in some kind of more cool and flexible way and try to buy us off? Why do they always go for our heads? Why do they always overreact, like in this Walker report on Chicago that you mentioned? People always say, well, why do the police get out of control? Why do they go off on unnecessary repression? I think it's because they understand better than we ourselves do. They understand better than the protest movement does what's coming. They understand the handwriting on the wall before we even get our day glow and write it there. They understand what's happening, and instead of regarding them as paranoid and insane, we should try to understand that what they think is probably what is about to happen. After all, they're very smart people. It takes pretty smart people to run such a complex society, right? We always say that. We must be intelligent. We could not be run by a group of mental deficient morons. They must be very intelligent. So how can they be intelligent about running corporations, universities, but be dumb about handling protest? It's impossible. They are either dumb across the board, which doesn't explain anything. They're not. I know why you're clapping. They are dumb in a certain way, but they're not dumb in the ordinary sense, because they make the airplanes fly, they make the trains go, they get the food on the table, they get rockets to the moon. They do all kinds of things that require a certain form of intelligence. It may be a perverted intelligence, but it is extremely intelligent. So they can't be, they can't possibly be smart about going to the moon and stupid about protesters. They have one mind, one set of mental faculties, one intelligence, and it has to be universal in the way it's applied. So there must be something intelligent in the way they approach us. And I think that if we understand this history of blood, we understand their minds much more. And instead of paranoia, we can see that they think that they're going to get what's coming to them. That's what they think. They believe that they're going to get what's coming to them because they know the history of blood. It's not like forgotten. It's something that they have cocktails about at the Caravelle Hotel in Saigon. Something that they drink to at the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco. It's something that, for instance, the Hearst family knows all about privately. And one cannot have too much blood on one's hands before one develops the Macbeth complex, which is a belief that one's victims will return from somewhere to haunt you to the grave. If one knows how many hundreds of thousands of deaths one is responsible for, one cannot help but start to believe that they live in a very haunted place. You see, the whole, you know, why do people commit terror? Why are genitals cut off and stuffed in people's mouths? Why are mass graves dug and whole populations shot and people buried? And why is the sand put over the bodies? And why is history so carefully rewritten? Why are yesterday's killers made into the people who today hotels are named after? It is because the purpose of terror, the purpose of genocide, the purpose of this kind of insane bloodiness is not just to kill the Indian who's being killed, or the black, or the Chicano, or the Vietnamese, or the freak, or the student at Kent State. They're merely the bodies. The idea behind terrorism and genocide has always been to kill the spirit, to kill the example, to kill off the idea of resistance, to kill the counter-values and counter-culture that is a threat to the occupying culture and the occupying army. Because as long as there is an alternative, as long as there is an idea, as long as there is a value that is outside of the control of capitalism, it is a threat. As long as people are capable of believing that there is an alternative way of life to this rat race, that belief is the threat. And whether it's killing the Indians at Sand Creek, or the Nazis killing the Czechoslovakian people at the village of Lidice in World War II and making them disappear under the sand, terror always has the purpose of trying to erase history, make it disappear so that it seems like we're the first people on Earth, or at least the first to settle America. Nothing before and nothing ever after. One way of life for all. No alternatives to it. This is the only way of life. This is the best way of life. Make the most of it. That is the purpose, always has been the purpose of terror. And that's why the discovery of an alternative and the breathing of an alternative, the creation of an alternative through action, discussion of an alternative in rooms like this, in and of itself, is dangerous, because it means that Cochise is not dead. It means that all of those people who are supposed to be dead have their ideas carried on down through time and implanted in other people's minds. And as long as that goes on, people at the top will run scared, will panic. Because how would you like to be haunted by the ghosts of the Apache guerrillas? And they are haunted. That's why in Vietnam, commanders talk about Viet Cong country as being Indian country. It's Indian country. You know, and that's why the treatment of the Vietnamese is the same as the historical treatment of colonized people in this country. It's this tremendous fear. That's why they're paranoid, because they know it's all coming to an end, and they might be held responsible. And if their victims use Anglo-Saxon standards of justice to judge the Anglo-Saxons, then there would be a lot of heads rolling. And there is this fear that the victims will one day do to the executioners what the executioners have done for hundreds of years to the victims. This is why there's so much paranoia. This is why there's so much hysteria. Because they do believe everybody is the same. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And if they fall from the top, we will rise like a pack of dogs, devour them, and slaughter them. So that's why there's so much paranoia, I think. It also gives us one last thing, which is hope. All of this history is a process. We get tired after demonstrating once every fall for 5 years. That seems real exhausting. Well, actually, it's only in this context, the latest series of demonstrations, very modest demonstrations, in a long history of demonstrations, violent, nonviolent and otherwise, against people who settled this country, the people who developed its capitalist institutions, the people who now have expanded this country into a world empire. And we are just taking part in the dismantling of this empire, because it is, I think you know, at an end. People talk a lot about the radicals being a lunatic fringe, you know. Or they say that all these Black Panthers and these Chicanos are sort of, just romantic diehards fighting their last battles. And the Indians at Pitt River are just romantic diehards who haven't quite accommodated to their defeat. And I think the reverse is true. I don't think that People are now picking up weapons. People are now going into forms of resistance simply because of a last gasp psychology. I think that it's not like a new ghost dance or something like that. It's not like we're sort of Luddites rebelling against our inevitable fate. I think people only move to these extremes when hope has returned, and I think that hope has returned. It's a very desperate hope, but it's definitely hope. I don't think people are motivated to resist because they don't believe it's possible to live. I think they're motivated to resist because they know what life is, and they know that it's possible to expand it and to defend it. And this is what's happening. And people talk a lot about us being the lunatic fringe. I don't think that that's true. I don't think that we are 1% of the college population or something like that. I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about yippies and freaks being, you know, sort of people who've fallen off the mainstream of society and are some kind of new group of crazy people who can't, like, adjust psychologically to the needs of the classroom and industry, but that America will go forward and that these freaks will sort of freak out for about 10 years and come back. I don't think that that's true. I think that the very act of dropping out is so new in the history of student movements among white people in this country that it must mean that something new is happening. And people are not dropping out of society because they don't like where society is going. They're dropping out of society because they also realize that society is going nowhere. So it's not so much an act of dropping out of something that's growing, but it's leaving something to develop something else. And I think that we all sense this, that we're in a situation where the basic things that motivate us are not profit, are not the desire to make just enough money to get by. We don't really believe deep down in our guts that our role in life is to go from this college and this community to start a small business and see that it grows into a larger business so that we can compete and put some other people out of business and one day have the largest business. I don't think even the most conservative students on this campus really believe that that old puritanical capitalistic ethic is for them. And that is because it is really impossible to start those small businesses. It is impossible to revive this form of economic life. It is impossible because it's developed to its fullest. In fact, it's overdeveloped. There is no room for you to develop a little enterprise to start competing with General Motors. There is not enough, you do not have enough time, enough friends, and enough money to develop an alternative to General Motors. Therefore, you have to try to think of something besides going into the capitalist rat race to develop from scratch. And Ronald Reagan doesn't understand this because he belongs to a period in time when there was at least some definite meaning to the Horatio Alger view of life. There was, sure, Horatio Alger was a racist, he was a genocidal maniac, he had no regard for a fellow human beings, but at least Horatio Alger was a person who was realistic for his time. Horatio Alger could look around and say, I have nothing, but I'm going to get something. Horatio Alger could compete like a little dog and join the pack and fight with other people and get things from them and rise to the top of the pack. It was possible early in Ronald Reagan's boyhood to imagine such a way of life. It's no longer impossible to be Horatio Alger, and this is the nostalgia that is behind the repression. This is the this is also the solid fact that makes it impossible for us to do the bidding of Ronald Reagan, even if we wish we could. It is not objectively, structurally possible for us to do what he and Hayakawa and George Murphy and William Randolph Hearst would like us to do. Because they have used up that system to its maximum, they have developed it to a level where it is no longer possible for people to really make their way within it, except as organization men or small cogs or bureaucrats who have to follow somebody else's orders. They have also developed it to such a level that the people of the world have condemned it. have condemned it so totally that if you know that if you go to work for it, you will be considered criminal in the eyes of most of the people of the world. If you go to war for it, you'll probably be killed or wounded or fight in a miserable, stinking, rotten, dirty war that will not be appreciated by even your fellow Americans when you return to this country. And in that situation, the possibilities for the people on the top are drying up. It's the same situation that for us is just full of opportunities. And I don't really profess to know like where it's going, because I think we're still in the first stage, something like the Enlightenment stage of revolution, when values and new ideas are spreading, controversies are taking place. People are just beginning to think of getting themselves together. People are just beginning to form alternative institutions. People are just beginning to write in a new language, to relate to people in a new way, to start organizations that serve their own needs. We're very young, and the situation is very new. And perhaps it has to spread, this great transformation of values has to spread through all of these colleges, one by one, before we can get on to another stage. But I definitely know that, you know, the way of the future is not Art Linkletter. I know that. And you also know that. And more importantly, it is not a future that's going to be defined by me or any other individual personality that the mass media has allowed you to know about. At one time, maybe 10 years ago, or in an earlier stage, it might have been necessary in places like Ann Arbor or Berkeley or Harvard for people like myself who learned a lot of the aggressive, acquisitive skills of competitive society to go out and give speeches and rally people. I could have been a good businessman. You know, I was conditioned and socialized and trained to be able to, I probably would have been a better lawyer for businessmen than a businessman. I was trained to learn how to put people down, trained how to make the right argument, trained how to push ahead when other people were confused, you know, trained how to fight against people who were in my way. All of those kind of skills might be necessary when you're starting from nothing and you have to like smash your way into existence in a society that has no left, that has no radicalism, that has no alternatives. But now, 10 years later, things have really changed. And unfortunately, the establishment doesn't understand that. They still put my comrade Rennie Davis and John Freund's in the penitentiary yesterday, and they'll probably keep them there as if it was Rennie Davis and John Freund's that caused 7,000 people to get themselves arrested 2 days ago. The establishment definitions will go on because for hundreds of years the establishment has thought that individual leaders were the people to get, buy them off, give them whiskey, was the old form. Put them in front of the television camera is the new form. Or put them in the penitentiary if they're not satisfied with being on television. And this, as you know, won't go down because the thing that's happening is really the dismantling of centralized society, the dismantling of the Pentagon-dominated society, the dismantling of General Motors-dominated society, the dismantling of a college system that's centralized in the hands of a few businessmen and trustees. And the alternative to this society that's being destroyed is not a new centralized movement with some commanding officers and some troops. Our model is not a vertical army or a vertical corporation with a drawing room for Rennie Davis and other people to sit in and figure out the plans and then transmit them to the lower echelon officers. Our movement is a very different thing. It does not depend on this sort of individual thing because people have definite needs that they have to realize. And if leadership does not get anywhere, if things don't happen one way, then people will make them happen another way. So today, an individual might have brought you out, but the real thing that brought you out is a very definite set, and you know this better than I do in a more detailed way than I do. The real thing that brought you out is a very definite set of needs that you have to fulfill in your lifetime, right? For community, for an end to racism and chauvinism and militarism in all forms, for some opening up of relationships so that people can be whole. Whatever it is, you don't know the answers, but you have a definite need to search for them. And this is not simply a psychological need. It is an objective need that befalls people whose civilization is coming to an end and who need, in the midst of the disintegration and collapse of that civilization, to begin finding new answers. And that's why, regardless of what happens to individuals, things are going to go on, because you have these needs, and these needs are widespread. These needs involve millions and millions and millions of people. And I hope that the next time that you come together, it will be around some kind of action that you can all participate in, and that whatever your differences, that you settle them in a family way, that you settle them in a non-sectarian way, that you realize that everybody in their own way. Possessed by this need to find a new alternative, and some people will maybe want to go out and fight the establishment very directly. Some people will want to read. Some people will want to try to create an alternative through music and art rather than through confrontation. And all of these differences, which are very real, should be settled in a constructive and healthy way based on the realization that it is a community that we're building that's going to be the alternative to this empire. That is what's behind, for instance, the Berkeley election. Many people think that the Berkeley election somehow shows that electoral politics is successful, and all we have to do is join the system and work that way to get what we want. Mainly it's Newsweek that says things like this and Wall Street Journal. But many people in Berkeley will bomb the Bank of America one day and pass out literature for the candidates of the April Coalition another day, because they're into an experimental thing. No one tactic has worked, from elections to bombings, over the last 10 years, when you think about it. The only thing that had, and people are crazy to get hung up on one tactic as opposed to another. The only thing that has worked, the only thing that seems to continue to work, is the growth of a radical spirit and a community that is the source of strength for people to employ different tactics at different times depending on the situation. That's really, as you know, what's behind Berkeley. You can't divorce the April election from the 10 years of growth of a new culture and the different kind of radicalism in Berkeley. That's what the election victory is built upon, not on the sudden discovery that we could register ourselves to vote. It's not built on the sudden discovery that through running for office we can get our way. If we had only discovered it 10 years ago, we wouldn't have to have all these dead bodies and all these jail sentences. It is the community and the growth of a community alone that is going to see us through. It's both the source of resistance and the beginning of the kind of society that we're going to have after we destroy the empire. Right on. We'll have I hope that you're clapping for yourselves. I hope that you're clapping for yourselves because, see, just to reinforce it further, and we can have questions and discussion now, but everything I said is created by you. It's not created by me. It does not, if somebody gets up here who does not know how to speak as well as I do, for instance, or feels intimidated, it's because you have not given that person enough confidence, and you're not giving that person enough support. But anyone can do this, and it's not like a thing that you should applaud an individual for. I really should be applauding you, because you are the force that creates the ability of people to speak and the ability of people to feel that things are going somewhere. It's not the other way around, and that's the constant thing that we have to fight in these rallies. Rallies are good, but not if the energy gets turned around into a consumption thing. And I know that you didn't mean it that way, and I appreciate that, but you should really applaud for yourselves and turn on the music and applaud for yourselves some more, and then talk or do whatever you want to do, because you are the force that brought you here today in this assembly, you know. At least I think you are.
We're going to have a few questions, but first of all, we have a couple quick announcements. Outside, when you leave, there's going to be this blue sheet of paper, a student housing request petition. If you really want it, let's get it on and get this thing signed up. This is really important. No, you don't have to read it. You'll see it outside. Also, there's going to be a meeting of SNAP at 11 o'clock at E45 next Tuesday, if you're interested in that. And tomorrow, we're going to try to get it together downtown. We're going to carry this on. Tomorrow's no business as usual. There's certain establishments downtown that need a visit by a lot of people, including the Bank of America, Standard Oil, Selective Service. So let's try to get together sometime like 11:30 or 12 at the Mission Plaza downtown. We're going to have some guitar players. We're going to walk around downtown and just go in and try to get these people. So let's show up to that. That's really important. We need a lot of people. Also, if you can't get downtown, if you can't do this trip, we encourage you, number one, not to use the snack bar, the El Corral bookstore, and any other function that you have to pay for on this campus. And in fact, I would go further and encourage you not to come to school tomorrow, to close down this place too, because it's business as usual. Okay, I'm going to turn it back over here to Tom for...
We have a while. If there are questions, if people in the back want to come up, there's more room now along the sides and in the front. I know you've been just standing there. It will take a minute for people who have to go.
What time is it?
I worked in Newark in the black community for 4 years until 1967-68. And with a number of other people, we worked right after the rebellion, in which 24 blacks were killed. We worked to try to describe how they were killed, case by case. Just a community organizing project. We had a lot of help from attorneys from Poverty Program Legal Services Project and some reporters, but no, nothing beyond that. No, the police were very interested in it because they had killed 24 people, and They brought me before a grand jury. That's about as close as I got to any official things. They were trying to find out if they could bring a lawsuit or some slander suit about, you know, about the book to cover up their tracks. But no, there was nothing done. There was an investigation of Newark done by state officials, which turned into the indictment of the mayor and a city council for being mafia connected. But that seemed to be like what they're doing to Alioto, which is the Republicans can't get rid of the Democrats through elections, so they get rid of them through indicting them for being mafia. And this is good, but it's sort of like a fight within the system. And that's what happened in Newark. The whole government was indicted for being mafia. People hear that? What's our assurance after the revolution that things won't go back to the present? Well, the people who are responsible for the present won't be around, presumably. And that's one thing. It really, you know, it depends on your involvement and your faith in the process. Like, I look upon you as being the insurance, but you evidently don't look upon yourself necessarily as being the insurance. Like, if you're so concerned about it, then you're the best insurance. The more people who are concerned about preventing backsliding, the less chance there will be of backsliding. And I don't know what else you can say about that, honestly, because you can't guarantee something like that. And revolutions are not made in some rational way like rich people eat dinner. You know, they don't. It's not like sitting down in a high-class restaurant with a menu and saying, well, what'll I have after dinner tonight? I'll have this kind of dessert or this kind of dessert. Revolutions are made by people who don't have those options. They spring from necessities, and people usually make who want to make a change that profound are very willing to improvise along the way because they have faith that that's the only thing they can do. I mean, I could give you a whole political science thing about what it'll all look like afterwards, but I think that would be like a false promise, you know. And the real thing is that you can't guarantee this, and the only guarantee, as much as there is one, is by being part of it and arguing all the way along the line about the kind of things that you would like to see done and not done at the end. And, pardon me? Will it be more of a peaceful government or a peaceful anarchy? Well, maybe other people can pick that up. I mean, maybe that's a thing that other people want us to talk about or say things about. If you want to use the microphone to talk, you can do that too. Yeah. People hear that. Said if revolution is about an idea, then as long as that idea persists, it'll be really hard to sink it or destroy it or erase it until a better idea comes along. Yeah, I wouldn't just place my faith in the climate of opinions. I mean, there should be some kind of institutions and structure, but I agree fundamentally with that. Yeah. What's the April Coalition going to do in Berkeley? Well, the first city council meeting of the new city council is today. As you know, the city council is deadlocked, so it doesn't seem like there'll be any kind of immediate progress. The way that we think about it is that it was just a step, and we have to do is take advantage of the results, the chief of which is that a huge number of people really believe in community control of the police, community control of planning of neighborhoods, community control of child care, and so on, and that these programs can be started and get the city council to come along behind and endorse them, you know, rather than waiting on the city council to initiate the programs. We think that we have a lot of ways to initiate them ourselves and try to involve the friendly members of the city council in the process, rather than just waiting on politicians to, you know, do things that we should be able to do as a community. But I don't know, that election is really very exaggerated in a lot of ways. People say it's a great radical victory, but the candidates aren't that radical. You know, they're no more radical than people in this room. That are not like unusually radical or something like that. And it's also claimed to be a great victory for working within the system, but even the candidates who ran didn't advocate that they were working within the system. They just saw it as, you know, maybe one way to get some representation and more things going your way. And especially since we have a potential majority, why not take advantage of it? You know, it was a sort of low-keyed reasoning on the part of the people who were in the campaign, but afterwards, the press has made very inflated predictions about it and interpretations of it, we think. It's a good thing, but it's not like the major thing that it was described as. Yeah. Sorry, I can't hear you. I don't know what the Chinese and Russians would think if they heard somebody was working for both of them. These are really long things, and I don't want to take up the time, but I mean, if you just want a simple, really, like, quick answer, I think that, you know, that there's really, like, at least two, perhaps three varieties of communists outside of the United States in these countries. And the first, exemplified by the Russians, are, you know, people who have made a revolutionary change that has broken down the feudal past and has, you know, started a huge population of people on their way towards a lot of progress in education, public health, better standard of living, and so on. And at the same time, the Russians, you know, have a less of a media. They're becoming part of the industrialized bloc and have certain tendencies towards wanting to be part of the haves rather than the have-nots. And as a matter of fact, they function in their foreign policy very often against the interests of you know, countries like Cuba, Vietnam, China, Korea. You know, for simple purposes, we call those Russian communists revisionist communists. Also, the nature of their revolution was very important to understand. It was a revolution that took place not in the whole country, not countrywide, but it took place in more limited areas among more limited segments of the population who overthrew the government in a coup. And this is even more true of those Eastern European countries who had, who call themselves socialist countries like Czechoslovakia, but really were socialist in the sense that with tremendous outside pressure from the Russians and some pressure from within, they created a socialist government after World War II. But they did not go through the thoroughgoing transformation of society that would make all of the people really socialist. So, like, you know, I think of those countries as being very much part of the West, although they have different kinds of economies. But I think if you talk about China or Vietnam in particular, talk about very different kinds of countries, because not only are they poor, but their process of socialist revolution has been based on people's war rather than on this short-term, more limited kind of warfare. And so the people in those countries, and I've been in those countries, really have gone through such thoroughgoing changes that they're almost different kinds of human beings. I mean, very impressive, no great distinctions, you know, between the elite and ahead of the United States in creating civilization and creating something that people can believe in. But at the same time, I don't really think that that those societies can serve as a model for revolution for people inside of this society, because of the technology here, because of the complete urbanization of the society, because of the different cultures that exist within this country, and so on. Say it louder, the last part. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last part. I really couldn't. I don't know if I really understand what you're saying. I think like, if, like, our form of economy has reached its limit in terms of expansion, in terms of its role in history, then things start breaking down. And the most massive way that they break down is that people have great difficulty believing in the capitalist way of life that Nixon stands for and those values. Not because just people disagree with those values, but because those values actually are dying, and it's really hard to recreate them. You cannot, like, be the self-made man and so forth. Those values are objectively coming to an end. And so the questioning is the most widespread thing. And what people call the Cultural Revolution, or whatever you want to call it, the alternative culture, is really like the first phase of the breakdown, as people start putting together new values in their heads. And that's the most massive thing in terms of the numbers of people involved in it, because it is the creation, beginnings of the creation of a different culture. Within that, there's a political movement, which is much smaller, but is much more aggressive, active, programmatic, and organized, which is trying not simply to drop out of the old society and become part of widespread questioning, but is trying to hasten the end of the old society and trying to fight it, because people who are part of the political movement within this culture understand that the society is falling apart because it's being pressured, not just because of some process, but because actual people are making demands and are trying to change things. And the political movement, I think, is much smaller. That's like all the people who go to moratoriums, demonstrations, and so on. Within that, there's you know, the revolutionary element, which is the most conscious, the most militant, and the most totally dedicated to an all-out do-or-die fight. And that number of people is very, very small, and very, very important, but very, very small. And I don't know how you fix a timetable to any of this. I didn't mean that things are just going to evolve forever. I think like the Vietnamese and the people who are black and brown in this country are speeding up the timetable very fast. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily a long process or just an evolutionary process, but I don't know how you can fix a date or, you know, speak in terms of any kind of timetable, or concrete timetable at all. In fact, I don't understand your question. Yeah. Well, yeah, see, I think we've got to get down to specifics because everything's been on too general a level, and things are only real if you limit them somehow. Everything else is good discussion. Like, you know, I don't know, like, what form it takes here, but I would think, you know, that there's a lot of people forming into communes, are there, and splitting this place? Or splitting LA and living in the country here? That's one form of it. That has certain problems, right? Because if we do that, we sort of leave it to the people who can't split the city to destroy the old society while we create the new society. And there's a lot of racism in that. But that's one form that it certainly takes. It's very concrete. I don't know what else happens here. You know, I was just at Valley State. In a Valley State, hundreds of people were arrested and are still fighting around things that have more to do with changing the college than with, like, splitting to create a completely new alternative. And it really seems to vary from place to place. But there at Valley State, they're still fighting over the EOP program. And people actually last week began to serve jail terms for demonstrating 2 years ago and getting into confrontations, out of which came the EOP program. Now they're going to jail for 4 months to 6 months. And that's all still focused on trying to change that university, trying to change that college, trying to make it into something that can be used to satisfy people's needs. Where, you know, other places, people seem to be splitting altogether. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, and just from your own opinion, and what you've seen, what effect it is having on our government.
Well, the government would be the last to acknowledge that it was having an effect. So you wouldn't look to Nixon to verify that you were getting somewhere. Like 10 o'clock yesterday morning, I think it was, John Mitchell, you know, had to make his announcement. What was it? The roads are clear. The government is functioning. Just to reassure all Americans that the government was still there. And the police chief had to go out of his way to compare the demonstration to just a heavy rain. See, this is like part of their psychological warfare, is obviously to make you feel, you know, that it was really hopeless, that you were like 7,000 raindrops or something as far as the police were concerned. Well, I don't think that that's true, because I don't think that the government likes the fact that it just arrested 8,000 people. When was the last time that a government of the United States has arrested 8,000 people in its capital? I don't think any time in American history have there ever been more than 800 arrests or 1,000 or 2,000 arrests in one place. And if you look at it in the context of, you know, showing people and needing to show people where the government is at, making them bring in the Marines and land in the nation's capital to arrest 7,000 people, and making the whole country wonder for several days whether the government's strong enough to be open for business against 10,000 freaks. You know, I don't think like years ago you would have thought that 10,000 freaks could stop the government of the United States. Well, maybe they can't, but like for a week, all America has been debating whether or not, you know, it could actually be done. Oh yeah, it could be done, and, you know, and well, yeah, they could cut those roads, and then the government would come to an end, and for several days we wouldn't have a government, and what would happen then? I think like it raised a lot of good questions, and I mean, I don't think that any one event ever is the decisive event, and I think a lot of questions could be raised about the Washington action, like, you know, I don't know if it was worth it to have 7,000 arrests. That could be debated. I don't know if going through a process to show everybody what the government's like is worth the price of 7,000 arrests. You know, maybe it would be better to have those 7,000 people doing things all around the country in their communities. But, you know, these are legitimate questions, but we do know that continued pressure through all kinds of demonstrations and actions has had some effect on the government. The people who have the most effect are the Vietnamese, right? People who have the second most effect, I think, probably have been the people in the black and brown communities inside of the United States who, like, forced the government to you know, have several fronts at home to have to deal with, which makes it harder to fight in Vietnam. People who have had the third most effect have been the anti-war people, who have made it legitimate for you to express your disagreement with the policy, made it legitimate for this questioning to spread all the way across society. And the result of that, I think, has been the spread of the same questions from the black and brown communities and the white communities into the armed forces, who now, like, are in a position, like this veteran said, you know, to really, like, cause a tremendous problem. And Nixon says he doesn't want to be the only president to, what was it Jane Fonda said? Nixon doesn't want to be the only president to lose a war, but actually he'll be the first president to lose an army. Think that that's true, that gradually, you know, the army will collapse and disintegrate. And no one of these things in and of itself has been sufficient, but it's been the combined accumulating pressure of more and more and more action and more spreading of these questions that gradually, you know, brings the whole thing down. And that's I think, the way it has to be looked at. Otherwise, you get into too much worry about whether this tactic was correct, and especially you get into a state of hopelessness if your 1 week of demonstrations didn't seem to have an impact, which I think a lot of people feel after the Cambodia thing, you know, that didn't work, so why do it again? And actually, you know, it did work a little bit, and if it didn't work so well, then the thing to do is not give up, but to figure out what was wrong with it and do it better the next time, and then what was wrong with that and do it better the next time until, you know, you really have it together. Yeah. You go to what? He said a very important thing. I don't know if it can be summarized very easily, but it was that, you know, the problem for him is that he feels that he's going nuts, going crazy, and being very unfulfilled because he finds himself having these ideas and feeling that he's never able to change anybody's mind. He's surrounded by people who don't agree. He's not getting anywhere. And what do you do to, you know, deal with this sense of, you know, feeling unfulfilled, feeling crazy, and so forth? And I think that that's the way a lot of people feel, and it's one of the reasons, again, that, you know, we have to think of a program and a way of moving that involves everybody rather than following organizations or individuals or people whose names you know, because you can't get fulfilled that way. You can only be a radical consumer, and that's the most unfulfilling thing of all. I think that one way people are trying to deal with this is by very practical steps based on the idea that the revolution is about life, and you don't postpone life until after the revolution. The Vietnamese and most people that you see really fighting are fighting because they believe in life, and they are a life force. And so it's important to form projects, form collectives, form small groups that give you some kind of support, that give you something practical to do that does not require, you know, getting the government's permission or the university's permission, but is a real thing that satisfies your interests and is some kind of service to the people. You know what I'm talking about, whether it's an underground newspaper or it's some kind of food conspiracy, or it's just a you know, collective of some other kind, because that allows you to realize that it's not some kind of individual isolation or unfulfillment, but that it's collective. We all feel unfulfilled. And it doesn't mean it can go away. That's the other thing I just want to say briefly. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything that a person can do that will make this go away. Otherwise, there would be no need for a revolution. And there's no getting around the fact that while revolution is about life and change is about life, it is also a fact that the people who are doing the changing come from the muck of the society that they're trying to change. We come from the muck of white Western Anglo-Saxon civilization. And if we were free of that muck, there would be no need for revolution. It's precisely the desire to get rid of this muck that drives us to try to change it. But that means that we're going to always have a tendency to be fucking each other over, to be doing things that are insane and stupid, to be looking for ways out instead of looking for ways to have a confrontation with the system. There'd be like all these problems. And so I think you can take steps to deal with your problem, but it can't be dealt with like some people, I guess, think that the revolution's in your head. And, you know, you don't have to, like, destroy the social order. You can actually create a completely fulfilling lifestyle right now. And I don't see that unless you erase your conscience and blind your eyes and so forth. I don't think, you know, it's possible to just create a utopian situation for a few. But you can certainly, you don't certainly have to be a mimeograph machine to make the revolution. You know, you can do a lot of things that are very good. Okay, in the back.
What time is it?
A little louder.
Thank you.
Because I don't think that violence in itself has always been bad and always will be bad. That would force me, if I felt it's bad and that was the end of it, then that would force me to think that Nazis were like communists and Adolf Hitler was like Mao Zedong and the Black Panthers were like Chicago policemen, because all of these people use violence. And since I know they're not alike, and since I think that some are better than others, represent better values than others, I can't use violence as the only criteria for evaluating a group of people or a class or a situation. Otherwise, you get into, there's this whole thing that is especially a college textbook thing about power and about violence. Over and over, I bet you are told and lectured to and read things that say something like this: all revolutions are basically the same. One group of people has power, another group has no power. The second group overthrows the first group and gets power, and then the situation's the same again. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, blah, 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 blah. Which, like, same with violence. All violence is the same, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that that's like taking a flat iron, to history or something. It's like, it's just impossible to believe that all history is reduced to everybody being the same because of power and violence. I think like today, some countries have a better way of life and standard of living than others. Some people use less violence than others. Some people have more justification for using violence than other people. And so forth. And I think like you have to be able to judge it in a complicated way like that, rather than taking a position that all violence is bad and all power is bad, because that seems like a way to maintain a stance of purity, but actually it leads back into the protection or the protective cloak of American power and American violence. Because if you say that violence is bad to people who are now under that boot of the American Empire, you're essentially telling them that they shouldn't revolt against the people who now have the means of violence and have this power. And you're telling them not to revolt. Why not? Because they'll become like you? Because they'll become like Nixon? What? It just doesn't make sense. It leads you, as a pacifist, into siding with the people who have the most violence. Because you never justify the right to revolution.
Larry Elmore, please
come to the information desk.
Yeah, we will. Take him in the car?
Rumor, what? That's a good question to end this meeting on. I think I have to go. What was the meaning of that question? Comment on the ping pong diplomacy. Well, it shows, that the Chinese have it more together than white Americans. They're superior. They have in every way. They can beat us in war, beat us in ping pong. And I really accept this and have adjusted to it and don't feel badly at all at discovering that. And what was most interesting about the ping pong thing was, the way that they didn't defeat us too badly. This is the thing to tell people who are frightened that they're going to get what they deserve. See, the Chinese are not, trying to, smash us 21-1 or something like that. They send out their fourth string in order to beat our first string by just a couple of points. because they don't want to lose. That would be really, you know, that would like encourage America's aggressiveness. If we won at ping pong, then we would, you know, probably invade next. But they do like have this whole thing. I think like the delegation was really shook up. Some people were frightened and didn't want to go and were really frightened of China. But other people, like this student from University of Cincinnati, came back really impressed. And the result is, you know, really tremendous. I mean, it shows how many people in America would like to open up peaceful relations with China. I mean, there's virtually no one except the vice president, but there's almost no Americans, you know, masses of people who really are upset by what happened. They really, like, if it's good enough for Sports Illustrated, it's good enough for everybody. And it's sort of like this whole feeling, you know, that, you know, we would like to have a relationship as a people with the Chinese people is something that I don't think even liberal politicians believed was true, you know. That politicians have believed that America's really afraid of China, really doesn't want to relate to China, that it's very dangerous to advocate having a good attitude towards China. And then the ping pong match happens, and it turns out that a majority of the American people are either, you know, don't mind, or they think it's really interesting. And it's too bad, you know, it took 25 years to discover that. But I mean, I don't know politically what, you know, what it means or anything. But one thing, it does, a lot of people think, you know, that you have to get a liberal president to get change, but you notice who's advocating admission of China to the United Nations.